I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. Today on the Weekly Review, open space in Maryland. It's great, and more of it would be nice, but state lawmakers keep raiding the special fund set aside to acquire it. An advocacy group says nearly 150 farm families are waiting to sell the state development rights to their land, but the money isn't there. Today, a look at the battle to preserve more open space throughout Maryland. Plus, Governor O'Malley trims back a promise he made to state workers for their retirement. The legislature wrestles with a moral question about a French company and commuter trains. And in Baltimore, the CEO of Under Armour wants to build a hotel. The Midday Weekly Review starts after the news from NPR. And welcome to Midday Friday and the Weekly Review. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. Coming up in this busy hour, Kevin Litton of the Baltimore Business Journal has the latest in development news in the city, including a look at the plans of the Under Armour CEO, Kevin Plank, to build a $60 million hotel in Fells Point, and the possibility that an international jeweler will move its U.S. headquarters to downtown Baltimore. Kevin Litton joins us in about 40 minutes or so. And to finish out this hour today, Christopher Llewellyn Reed, one of our midday film critics, reviews two films, Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel and Divergent, which is being dubbed the new Hunger Games. That's coming up in the last few minutes of this hour. Before we get there, we'll also be speaking with Ann Jones of Partners for Open Space in Maryland, a group that's trying to stop the Maryland legislature from constantly raiding the funds set aside to acquire land for open space, parks, and recreation throughout the state. The group is engaged in a budget battle in Annapolis. And if you care about preserving land in Maryland, please make sure you listen for my conversation with Ann Jones. Speaking of the state budget, there's an aspect of it we want to take a look at right now with Barry Raskovar, political Maryland columnist, longtime contributor to WYPR, and a man who's been watching the Maryland General Assembly since the 1970s. Right, Barry? How you doing?
It feels like the Stone Age.
It does. That's a long time. So we're going to take a look at another budget here, and there's one aspect of this I wanted to get your perspective on, and that was the pension part of this, state workers' pensions. 3 years ago, Governor O'Malley made a deal with the state's public employee unions. State workers agreed to pay more of their salaries into the pension system, which is underfunded, and accept lower benefits for new hires, new workers. In return, the state promised to devote $300 million a year to shore up the pension fund. And now the governor proposed basically reneging on that deal by grabbing back about $100 million a year to plug a hole in the state's budget deficit. Right.
Right.
And the state Senate apparently went even further than that. So a little background on this.
Well, historically, when times are tough as far as balancing the budget in Annapolis, they look for easy ways to do it, and they look for pots of money that are lying out there that they can tap into. Sometimes it's open space money.
which we'll be talking about.
Yes, and sometimes it's pension money, and that's exactly what has happened this time. The state pension fund had gotten in trouble. The recession was one of the primary causes, but also because of the strong lobbying by state worker unions and teacher unions, the benefits had been increased. And also Governor Glendening had played around with withdrawing money that the state normally gave to the pension fund to use for other purposes. So when the recession hit, the bottom dropped out as far as the state pension fund was concerned.
And so to get it back in shape, the governor made this pledge 3 years ago. Now, what's the ramification of not, besides breaking a trust with your workers, what are the ramifications financially, potentially, for this state pulling back on its commitment on funding that pension?
Well, that's interesting because the whole controversy over fully funding pensions, state pension funds, has gotten a lot of publicity, and a lot of conservative groups have taken this up as a cause to show that liberal Democrats are ruining the pension funds. But in fact, there's a strong argument that you can make that you don't need a fully funded pension fund for state government. State government is not like General Motors. It's not going to go out of business. It's quite a different animal. So that the chances that you would ever have to pay out all of the money to all of your retired employee and future retirees at one time is virtually nil. So, that's the one side of the argument. The other side is that, well, the governor and the legislature made this commitment to put extra money in the pension fund so that in 10 years we'd be back to a level where it is 80% fully funded. And they reneged on that. They walked away from it, which reinforces in a lot of people's minds out there that politicians will not keep their word.
And we hear that echoed in the gasoline tax. The trust fund, the transportation trust fund.
Yes.
We heard echoed there. And we're going to talk a bit about the open space fund in a few minutes. Nancy Kopp, who is the state treasurer, spoke out about this. Actually, you wrote a column about it, Barry, saying it's a question of trust in all candor. We trusted $300 million, and now we're told to trust $200 million. Actually, the state Senate went down to $100 million, didn't it?
It was $100 million that O'Malley was proposing. The state Senate decided that they'd pull out $200 million of the $300 million that had been committed on an annual basis. O'Malley's proposal was even worse because he wanted to make this cut permanent, which over a 10-year period would have been a loss to the pension fund of $1 billion. And over a 30-year period, it's a $3 billion loss in money that is supposed to fund retiree benefits.
Why does the governor think he can do that? Because this is last year in office?
Yes.
He has a hole in his budget he needs to patch?
There's no consequences for him.
Minimum wage. Legislation to increase the minimum wage from $7.25 an hour to $10.10 an hour by 2017 passed the House of Delegates a couple of weeks ago, Barry. That stands now. I guess it's over in the Senate, right? Where does that stand?
It is blocked in the Senate Finance Committee. And fascinating development. Mac Middleton, who is the chairman of that committee, has said the bill does not move until I get what I want. But what he wants is directly related to the minimum wage bill, which is a substantial raise for disability workers. These are people who are specially trained to help those with developmental disabilities. They are very, very poorly reimbursed for their services. It is among the most difficult jobs that you can imagine. Yet they're paid less than $10 an hour, which means under the governor's bill, they would be getting less than the minimum wage. And that's what angered Senator Middleton.
Does the state regulate their pay?
The state regulates their pay because their pay comes from medical assistance.
Right.
So it's
interesting. He's taking a stand on that in the midst of this debate.
Yes, he is. And he's going to get his way, too. And I think to a large extent he's going to get it because most people in Annapolis understand Mac Middleton is right on this issue. Hmm. It's time that the state owned up to paying these individuals, 18,000 of them, a much better salary.
Do you think it's likely there'll be an increase in the minimum wage?
Oh, I think without a doubt there will be an increase in the minimum wage.
From the $7.25.
From the $7.25. Now, whether it gets to $10.10, as the governor wanted, that's an open question. Whether it takes longer to get to $10.10 is another question. The Senate committee is liable to make some additional changes to the bill to modify it further because there are some recent economic studies, one by the Congressional Budget Office, which shows quite clearly that you raise the minimum wage, it ends up costing hundreds of thousands of jobs nationally. And another study showed that economic growth could be stifled by up to 25%. So that it could be counterproductive to raise the minimum wage dramatically. And that's what the Senate Finance Committee is trying to balance. But in the end, there will be an increase in the minimum wage.
And Maryland did not have a great jobs report over the last month.
No, it did not. 10,000, almost 10,000 jobs.
Actually, over the last year, really.
Over 10,000 jobs were lost in January in Maryland. If that trend continues, and then the minimum wage is increased, you could see a lot of small business retailers affected to the point that they not only may lay off some people, they may go out of business.
This is Midday in the Weekly Review. Dan Rodrigues here with Barry Raskovar of PoliticalMaryland.com. Now I want to turn to a subject that you devoted a column to, Barry. I thought it was very thoughtful and very well written. I wanted to talk to you about this. Maryland is hoping for a $900 million federal grant for the Purple Line. That's the new commuter train line that's supposed to go through PG and Montgomery County in the D.C. suburbs. One of the companies bidding to build the Purple Line is connected to the French state-owned railroad CNCF.
SNCF.
What did I say?
SN.
Yeah, SNCF.
Société Nationale du Chemin de Fer.
Merci. SNCF.
Yeah.
Very good. All right. Now, SNCF was complicit with the Nazis during World War II in transporting more than 75,000 Jews from France to Germany, where almost all of those folks were killed. For a few years now, the issue has been raised in Annapolis, force CNCF to pay reparations to Holocaust victims in the United States and their families, whom the railroad company transported. Now, a lawyer with the Federal Transit Administration says prospects for the federal funding might be jeopardized by the legislation. And we heard from an official on this air in WYPR, an official of the State Department, who said, please don't do this.
Yeah, and the Attorney General's office chimed in and said basically the same thing. The kicker here is that the French government has gone to the United States government and recognized that there's a problem here, that while the French government, since the early 1950s, has been paying reparations to French citizens and other neighboring countries, those who survived the Holocaust, who were shipped on SNCF trains to the German border, they've not reimbursed those who came to America and took out citizenship here. So negotiations are now underway. Stuart Eisenstadt, who is a former Carter administration official, now represents the State Department in these negotiations. He's already on the record saying, Maryland, back off. You're just going to make this much more difficult if you proceed down this path.
Because he said negotiations are apace with the French.
Yes, yeah. Yes. But the other thing is that it's pretty clear from a past debate that went on in Annapolis 3 years ago, that a bill like this, if it is enacted, will not stand up in court because it's discriminatory. And if you discriminate against a bidder for a state contract that receives federal funds, you're violating not only state law but federal law. And there's really no way around it on this Purple Line contract. It's a massive, massive undertaking. They're not only trying to get $900 million in federal funds, there's another $700 million in low-interest loans that would go to the winning bidder so that they can build this thing. And also, it's a very essential line. It runs inside the Beltway in Prince George's and Montgomery counties and would serve a lot of low- to middle-income individuals who desperately need better transportation. It won't happen if this bill passes, and that's the dilemma now that supporters of the bill now face.
Boy, that is a dilemma. But they would have to trust the State Department to get the reparations that they're seeking in Annapolis. Annapolis is saying, basically, don't go forward with the Purple Line. Don't allow SNCF or this offshoot company of SNCF to participate in the bidding here until these reparations are made to U.S. residents who were affected by the transportation of Holocaust victims.
First of all, to think that a Maryland legislature can dictate what the French government is going to do, because SNCF is owned 100% and is part of the French government, very much like the U.S. Postal Service is here.
Right.
Demand reparations from one arm of the government when that foreign government is already paying reparations and is in discussions with the State Department. How the state of Maryland can control that situation is anybody's guess. The other thing is that, the U.S. State Department has had an abysmal record on the Holocaust going back to before World War II. And then after World War II, as far as
the refugee reparations, or
as far not reparations, but as far as handling the refugee situation from the concentration camps, the establishment of Israel, and so forth. A terrible record that the State Department has. And another question to ask is, where has the State Department been for the last few three or four decades in demanding from the French that they include American Holocaust survivors?
Correct, because the only the piece of this is that the payments that they have made, the SNCF has made, have not covered people who settled in the U.S. after World War II.
But SNCF has not made any reparations. The French government has.
The French government, okay.
Right. So I mean, this really should have been handled decades ago on a government-to-government basis, because if Maryland or these plaintiffs try to sue the Holocaust survivors, you run into the sovereign immunity issue, that you can't sue a sovereign immunity, a sovereign country in a federal court in this country.
I'm glad we had a chance to examine this, and you can find a link to Barry Raskovar's column on this issue on the Dan Rodrigues Facebook page. By the way, the legislation, there were two bills. Apparently, the one from the House did not get out. It didn't make it through the crossover. This is crossover time in the legislature.
Neither bill has moved out of committee.
Right.
And it's becoming late in the game. But things can happen very rapidly in Annapolis, and this is a very emotional issue. So, it could zip through in a hurry.
Thank you, Barry.
Thank you.
Barry Raskovar, look for his writings at politicalmaryland.com. He joins us once in a while here on the Midday Weekly Review. Time for a break. When we come back, open space in Maryland. It's great, and more of it would be nice, but state lawmakers keep raiding the special funds set aside to acquire it. An advocacy group says nearly 150 farm families are waiting to sell the state development rights to their land, but the money isn't there. Today, a look at the battle to preserve more open space throughout the state. A short break. We'll be right back. Hey, welcome back. This week on Midday, we devoted 2 hours to the subject of getting back to nature. A conversation on Tuesday with Richard Louv, the author and environmentalist who introduced the term nature deficit disorder. And yesterday, the first day of spring, we had a grand old time discussing what to do about nature deficit disorder this spring and summer, listing all kinds of ideas for enjoying Maryland's natural settings. Today, a continuation of that discussion with a look at what we're doing in Maryland to preserve more land for open space and recreation. Ann Jones joins us now from Partners for Open Space, an advocacy group engaged in a struggle in Annapolis to keep funds set aside for preserving open space for their intended uses. Ann, so welcome to Midday. Nice to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
This is an ongoing struggle to keep money in program open space. It's been going on for years, actually, and we're going to talk about that during this segment of the show. But first, I think it would be a good idea for you to just explain to folks what program open space is and where the money comes from that funds it.
Program open space is a designated portion. When you purchase a home in Maryland, there's a promise. A very small portion of your purchase price is a tax that's promised to go to fund the program open space programs. And there's four signature programs that are part of it. There is what's called stateside program open space, which funds the large parks that everybody likes to go to. There's local side program open space, which might be the playground down the street from you. There's the rural legacy program, which looks at large contiguous blocks of preserved land. And there's the Maryland Agricultural Land Preservation Foundation, which goes by the delightful acronym of MALF, which looks at prime and productive ag land and purchasing easements from that.
So it comes out of the transfer tax,
correct,
right? When you buy a house, and it's a very small piece of that, right?
Correct.
And how much money is usually in program open space? Can it get into the hundreds of millions of dollars?
It can get into hundreds of millions. It's been anywhere in recent years, as low as maybe when the housing market tanked, as low as about $90 million, mm-hmm. and it's been as high as almost $400 million.
So where are we today?
About $165 million coming in.
Coming in this year,
correct,
or sitting
or
there right
sitting
now.
There.
Sitting there right now. And that's underfunded. What would you say about that? There should be more? Or?
Well, the $165 million is there, but it's not being spent for program open space.
Oh, it's being held.
Yes. It exists.
Okay. It's being held by the legislature, by the governor's office, by whom?
The governors for the last, most of the O'Malley administration since the market tanked has replaced cash that comes in. So that's actual cash. That's the transfer tax sits in a, it should sit in a piggy bank as is shown on our
graphic. The graphic is now on Dan Roderick's Facebook page. If you want to take a look at this graphic that's been prepared by Ann's organization.
Right. And what has been going on is that money in the piggy bank has been going to use for other programs, and there's been a promise to pay it back with bonds. So the money is not actually accruing to the programs the year that it shows up. A portion of it is. So, for instance, this year, just to make it simple and not go into a whole lot of details on it, about half of the money that's coming in will actually go to do what's supposed to be done with the money. The rest of it's going in to pay for other programs in the general fund.
And because the budget does have a deficit, and we were just talking about that in the previous segment with Barry. Your organization did some research here and looked at the amount of money taken out of program open space over the last, four decades?
Right, since 1970.
Since 1970. When was it established, by the way, in the 60s?
Or very late 60s and early 70s.
Okay. And what did you find when you looked at amounts of money taken out of the fund?
It's been over $1 billion.
Over $1 billion. And you sit there and think of, well, what we could have done with $1 billion in Maryland. And let's go over that again. You said the state parks, playgrounds in local jurisdictions in the counties and Baltimore City, the Rural Legacy Program, and then ag land preservation. Let's talk a little bit about this.
Sure.
There are farmers in Maryland who are willing to sell off the development rights of their land, correct?
Correct.
What does that mean?
Well, what that means is that they agree. It's a huge decision. When somebody decides to sell their development rights, this is a decision in perpetuity. It involves different generations of a family. And it's a big decision for these landowners to make. And I kind of feel like when we look at this, it's almost like, you know, the Ravens were at the Super Bowl last year. Everything's lined up right now very well to have people want to preserve their land. Agriculture is a thriving industry in Maryland. You have a local foods movement happening right now. You have a lot of people that want to connect to the land. You have put in place policies through things like the tier system and the septic legislation that are limiting growth in other areas. You have some good zoning. So you're all teed up to really go ahead and really make a difference in the way Maryland will look in the future. And you have a dedicated revenue source to do it. It was dedicated to do this. It does not have to compete with all the other needs in the budget. The people who set up Program Open Space were well aware that there are many excellent programs that need to be funded. So they, when they set it up, they said, instead of saying, we're going to compete with those things every year, we're going to have a designated revenue source.
The transfer tax. Small piece of it.
And that is tied, because it's tied to the transfer tax, the hotter the real estate market is, the more money goes into it.
Right.
So there was a tie in there that made a lot of sense, and it was designated for that purpose. So now you've got willing sellers, you've got a political climate in terms of what's happened in regulations that encourages people to sell their development rights. You have a farm economy that's picking up, that both commodity crops are doing very well, and you've got the local food movement, and now the money's going away.
And just so people understand, the farmers remain, and they continue to farm.
Correct.
They just have sold off the development rights. You're not going to see tract housing where that farm was.
That's right.
And how many farmers in Maryland are willing to do this? Is there actually, it's hard to believe, but is there actually a waiting list?
Yes, there is. There's a waiting list for the MALF program, and that waiting list is smaller than it could be, because when you know that funding is limited, as I started out saying, these are huge decisions for farmers. And so you don't want them to come to that point and then say, oh, yeah, you just sit down over Christmas. Everybody decided they want to do this. You're making this decision to do it, but guess what? We don't have the money for it.
So when I use that number, nearly 150,
right.
Is that right? The waiting list, there are farm families in Maryland willing to sell off the development rights, 148 of them?
Those are just the ones who have applied to MALF. There's others in line at the Rural Legacy Program, and there's, because MALF has limited the number of people that are going to, that can apply right now. There are more people out there than that.
How many folks, if you ended up with if the program open space ended up with, say, $80 million, because you said
right.
about half
about
of
65,
it. Yeah. How many farm development rights? I guess it's hard to tell.
It's hard to tell because it gets divvied out because it goes to all four of those programs.
Okay, it goes to Rural Legacy. It goes to the state parks. It goes to
local
parks and recreation. Well, what do you think about this, folks? 410-662-8780 is the number here for Midday. Dan Rodericks with Ann Jones, whose organization is Partners for Open Space. And you can find their information about their organization, partnersforopenspace.org. There's a link to it on the Dan Rodericks Facebook page. And you also want to take a look at that graphic that they came up with to show where this money was supposed to go and where it's actually going. 410-662-8780 is our number here. Yates Claggett is with us now by phone. Yates Claggett is who's a farmer himself and has been very involved with the Farmland Preservation Program in Prince George's County. Mr. Claggett, thanks for joining us here on WYPR.
Very good. Thank you.
Yeah, I guess I'm a little surprised to hear that there is that big a demand for this money to sell off development rights among farmers. That's pretty impressive. What explains that? Why are farmers so eager to do this?
Well, you know, Dan, I think there's a couple reasons, and I'm looking at this from a Southern Maryland point of view. One of the biggest reasons is that in Southern Maryland, you know, we're not raising tobacco anymore. Many of the farmers took the buyout. In that contract, these farms had to stay in agriculture for 10 years. Many of those farms, the contract is up. Now these farms are able to be developed. And I think the impetus is to get the farms preserved now. Otherwise, you're going to be competing with these developers. We missed an opportunity over the last 10 years to preserve these farms while they were safe. Now, a lot of these farmers are retiring. You know, most of our tobacco farmers and our average farmer down here in Southern Maryland is in their 60s and 70s. They need equity out of the farm to retire, to maybe pass the farm on to the next generation so that the next generation can improve the farm, start a new enterprise, whatever it may be. You know, you look at Prince George's County, you don't think of a whole lot of farmland. You think of an urban area. We have 42 properties preserved for over 4,200 acres, and I've got another 2,500 acres in a waiting list right now. And that's just Prince George's County. Imagine the more rural counties and the need there.
Yeah, yeah. You know, those numbers are impressive for Prince George's County, but you don't think of it as a farming county, except, of course, in the southern part of it.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
This is a number I wanted to throw in here for our listeners to understand what's at stake, Mr. Claggett and Ann Jones. 25,000 acres a year. That's the estimate from the Maryland Department of Natural Resources on loss of agriculture and forest land to development each year, 25,000 acres. And, you know, with more population coming into Maryland, the state continues to grow. We have some choices to make here. Now, what goes on in Annapolis and with the legislators? They're just not sympathetic to this? They think this is, you know, preserving open space is a luxury for good times, good economic times. It's that you got to just be able to take this money. There's no law to stop them from doing it. I mean, what's the deal there?
I wish I could answer that. If I had the, you know, if I had the magic answer of why this continues to happen, maybe we could stop it from happening. But, you know, it seems as though every session there's something new that comes up. And the most recent one that just came up 2 days ago is a proposal to cap it in the future.
Let's talk about that. Cap it in the future. Is this from the O'Malley administration?
No, this is from the legislature and
so
from
cap,
the Senate.
You mean
it would cap
revenue
it.
Comes in from the sale of properties, right?
Correct.
The transfer taxes. And they reach a certain point and they say that's it for the program open space?
Correct. $100 million is what they're saying. And the estimate is that would cost another $250 million over the next 4 years.
The legislative ancestors of those in Annapolis now set up a pretty simple system here.
They did.
And what is it, 0.5%?
Correct.
Of the transfer tax revenue goes into program open space and they can't leave that alone?
Apparently not. I think it's, you know, it's somewhere like, you know, the total budget is $2 billion in the capital budget, as an example about. So you're talking about, you know, 0.5% or something of the budget, and they...
Yeah. I'm getting riled thinking about this because it's not just a line item, right? It's yeah. It's designated fund in a system for funding it.
Exactly.
I guess Yates Clagett. I guess you agree with me that this ought to be left alone and allowed to grow based on the amount of development that takes place in the state.
Well, and absolutely. You know, the problem here is that over the last 7-8 years, the housing market has dropped, so there hasn't been a lot of transfer tax. Well, the funds have not been there in that transfer tax. And furthermore, the agricultural transfer tax that's created when a farm is sold to a developer and redeveloped as a housing, that hasn't occurred. So our ag transfer tax accounts are down, and each of the counties gets a certain portion of that to use specifically for land preservation. But the issue is, now's the time, and over the last 7-8 years was the time when we weren't competing with developers. We should have been preserving these farms. The funding should have been ramped up at that point so that we could get out there and get these farms. Now, we may be competing with developers as the housing market improves, causing our easement prices to increase.
Mr. Clagett, thank you for your time today.
Very good.
Yates Clagett in Prince George's County. He's with the Farm Preservation Program down there in the Farm Bureau in Prince George's County. Let's take a quick call. I think this is Chris Delaporte. Is Chris Delaporte calling us? Chris? Oh, he's not there. A former city parks director who believes open space funds need to be dedicated in a trust and not touched. And I was guessing that was Chris Delaporte, who's been on our show before. Mike in Annapolis, we'll take your call instead. Hi.
Good afternoon. I've been involved with a group in Anne Arundel County that's trying to improve public access to the bay. And we've discovered thousands of waterfront acres acquired through Program Open Space that have not been made available for public access. And I'm not talking about private farmland. I'm talking about lands that are ostensibly parks, but there's no public access allowed. And that, I think one of the reasons that Program Open Space doesn't have a lot more advocates for it is because so many of us can't get onto the lands that are acquired.
Ann?
I know that there is, legislation, and I'm sure that you're familiar with it too, Mike, that's going through this session that's looking just at that and trying to do a study of how access can be guaranteed in more of the sites. The question comes up, and people wonder then about control. When you start opening it up to access, then you've got to make sure that people aren't trashing the place.
I wonder, is that always the point, though, to have public access? I mean, I get Mike's point,
yeah,
especially on access to the water, to the bay, right? But when it comes to open space, preserving open space, and know that a farm, a 2,500-acre farm, is never going to be developed. You drive by, you feel pretty good about that.
Well, that's right. The private property never requires access.
Right. But he's talking about areas where there may be public land and just no access.
But even some public lands are preserved for the purpose of, ecological benefits.
That's what we get with the Rural Legacy Program, right?
No, actually, that's more with the stateside program, Open Space.
And what does Rural Legacy get us?
Rural Legacy is designated areas so that within those areas, for instance, I work with one in northern Baltimore County, the Piney Run Watershed Rural Legacy Area, and it's about a 20,000-acre area where we have preserved about 14,000 acres. And so it can be farmland. It can be ecological areas.
Ann, what do you want folks to do listening today?
I want folks to talk to their legislators, obviously, to let them know it's important. We're going to have a big election coming up, as we all know, in the next time. And when you're out talking to candidates, let them know this means something to you. And hopefully get out and enjoy some of this open space that's out there this weekend.
Ann Jones with the Partners for OpenSpace.org here in Maryland. You can find their website, link to the Dan Roddick's Facebook page, and take a look at that graphic that they put together on what's become of program Open Space. And the threat of putting a cap on it is something folks should be concerned about. Ann, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you very much.
Folks, we need to take another break. When we get back, Kevin Litton of the Baltimore Business Journal joins us for the latest in development news. And Christopher Llewellyn Reed, one of our midday film critics, reviews two films, The Grand Budapest Hotel and Divergent. And welcome back to The Review. Kevin Litton joins us again. He covers commercial real estate development for the Baltimore Business Journal, a beat that keeps him very busy. So much to talk about, Kevin. Nice to see you again.
Great to see you. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with Kevin Plank. the CEO for Under Armour. This story came out maybe a couple weeks ago. It's pretty interesting, though. Kevin Plank wants to turn the old rec pier in Fells Point into a hotel. Other developers have talked about doing this for a number of years now.
That's right, and quite appropriate that the news would come out this year. It's 100 years old, the rec pier turns this year, and it's sort of sat languishing there, and they're really concerned at this point that it's been sitting there so long without any developers making progress on it, that that pier section that goes out into the water is actually at risk of collapsing into the harbor.
Ouch.
So the fact that Kevin Plank would come in and inject some capital into this project is really important because he has the means to do it, and that's what the developers in the past were not able to do, was to bring in some money to fix those pilings on that pier.
Did I see you describe it as a boutique hotel?
It has always been thought of as a boutique hotel because they wanted to do it in that original building and then out on the pier, so you don't have a lot of room. A boutique hotel usually refers to a luxury brand, but in a very small setting. So Kevin Plank's idea for it is actually to reduce the number of rooms that they had planned, which were over 200. Now he wants to do about 128 rooms. They want to restore the old ballroom that was used for big dance functions for the immigrant populations when it was originally built. That's going to be restored back to its historic splendor. It's actually in pretty good shape. They also want to do a ground floor restaurant where that beautiful arch on the first floor would actually have some glass behind it. That arch would all be preserved and you'd be able to look into the lobby, the restaurant, and the bar. They want to do sort of a living room-like lounge. They think lounges are really what makes great hotels. It's going to have two fireplaces at either end. It's going to open out onto a courtyard, and they're going to have a pool out on the end of it, which is going to offer great views of the Inner Harbor, but also the Under Armour campus right across the water.
Of course, over at Tide Point. How do Fells Pointers feel about it?
Fells Pointers are ready to see something happen on that project.
I think.
Well, they're in the middle of having the 600 block of Broadway being torn up by this marketplace project. The Broadway market's only half of which are open right now. But that's all supposed to get all finished here in the next, you know, 6-7 months. So that was really the missing link there, was to have all this brand new development that's getting Fells Point right back on track on the retail restaurant side, and then to have that thing sit vacant. So this has been really welcome news. The big reason that Kevin Plank needs support from that neighborhood is that he doesn't want to follow through with the city's plan to build a promenade around the structure. The city's always wanted to extend this promenade from Locust Point all the way over to Canton, but they actually wanted to build it around this building. And Kevin Plank, his development team, is basically saying, we don't think this could really be done. It's not historic to the building to have a promenade on it. So we'd rather extend the sidewalk out front, have a nice big wide promenade that goes from one side of Thames Street to the other.
Sounds like a small issue to deal with. Okay, that's exciting. Now, Pandora Jewelry. I must say, I wasn't really familiar with Pandora Jewelry until I started reading your stories about this. This is a very big jewelry company. It's all over the world. It has something like 10,000 points of sale internationally. It's in 80 countries, and its U.S. headquarters is in Howard County.
Yeah, and I didn't even realize that either until this story really came up. I was familiar with it because I've had friends that I've bought the charms for, and they make these charm bracelets that are just incredibly popular now, and they've gotten to be this really fast-growing company, which went public back in 2010. They're based in Denmark, but their U.S. headquarters have been in Colombia for some time. They have about 28,000 square feet down there. It's in this really inconspicuous building on Robert
Fulton
Drive.
Who knew this? I didn't.
So when I first started hearing
it's
about
this... It's a publicly traded company, right?
It's a publicly traded company, and when I first started hearing about it, I started reading up on their growth, and they've really had some remarkable growth. It's like 24% revenue growth here in the Americas. They opened 181 stores in the Americas last year, branded stores, and so they've just been doing really well. And when I looked back on their CEO statements when they had their stockholder meeting, they talked about how they were not able to keep up with their office growth to keep up with all this revenue growth. So that's what they're looking for, and it looks like they're in negotiations at 250 West Pratt, which is sort of this gray and blue. It's a gray building with blue windows, which you see sort of has a step.
Yeah, a staggered look to it, and it's near Camden Yards, right?
It's near Camden Yards, yeah, right. And it doesn't have a building name on it like you see on some of the other buildings.
So they want to put Pandora Jewelry up there?
That's what it's being marketed as. From what I hear, that's what really attracted them to the building, is that they get their name on a building downtown. I think it brings a really interesting diversity to downtown, where we are so heavy with law firms, financials, services, banks.
Right.
And so to have an actual product services company downtown would really, make an interesting mix. And they do say it's all about the accessories and the fashion.
And Brum Alamo Celta Towers right nearby.
Absolutely.
Talking about products. So Pandora Jewelry, that's an interesting story. And now I want to slip down to South Baltimore. You had a pretty interesting story here about a cardboard box factory in South Baltimore that a developer wants to turn into apartments. And that relates to another story you had that was pretty interesting. I think it was a cover story of the BBJ last week on people, new people moving into Baltimore, moving into old buildings like breweries, old schools, firehouses, even an old grain silo. But first, start with the cardboard box factory. What's the deal there? Is that Federal Hill?
That's South Baltimore.
South Baltimore.
I don't think it's Federal Hill proper, but it's...
You can't call everything Federal Hill in South Baltimore.
That's right.
There's a rule.
Yeah. So what's interesting about this building is that it's been sitting vacant for over 20 years, and it's really sort of a blight on the community. I think this is why it's gotten so much interest, is because they've really wanted to get revitalization done in that area. Hasn't really happened, and a lot of people think this building is because of it. It's an old cardboard box factory. They became known in the early part of the century as developing the cardboard box that you could use for shipping. They really revolutionized it. So it was placed on the historic landmark list because of that. Hmm. But the building looks terrible. They want to do 59 apartments in it. They want to make it really, you know, beautiful inside and put up a penthouse on the top, which is going to offer these sweeping views of downtown Baltimore. So it's a pretty small apartment project when you compare it to some of the larger ones that we've had.
Silo Point.
Silo Point was one of the bigger ones that opened, you know, about almost 10 years ago now. But the ones that are really getting a lot of attention now are the one that got me started on the story was the Gunther, which is down in the east side.
The old brewery.
Right across from Canton Crossing, where they just did an incredible job taking this old brewery that had sat vacant since the 1970s, hadn't brewed this beer in 30 years, and they turned it into this incredible historic conversion where when you walk through the building, you really get the feel and the flavor of what this was like as a brewery. They've got the old beer tank still in there.
Can you smell the hops anymore?
But it really got me thinking about how many opportunities you have in Baltimore to live in a building that was once used for something else and how those buildings are being preserved to keep that flavor going. I mean, 10 Light Street downtown is probably going to be the best example of this. This is the old it was the Bank of America building.
Maryland National Bank is the one I was trying to think of.
Yeah, and I mean, really got one of the best interiors in Baltimore. That first floor lobby is unbelievable, probably in the top three there. That's going to deliver next year just over 400 apartments. I think that's really going to get people excited about it. But it's not the only one. I mean, we have former office buildings you can live in. You've got the former brewery. You've got
schools.
A former Silo Point. Yeah, the Highlandtown Middle School project, another one where you walk through the halls and you still feel like you're in the school. You walk into your apartment, you might have a chalkboard in there or a mural from the old library. They've got those old windows that tilt out that are just like they were when they were in a classroom. So, you know, I think it gives Baltimore a really interesting edge when you're in competition for cities like D.C. and Philly. Baltimore has more historic properties on the register than most cities on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And now you get to live in those historic properties. So it really does add this great dimension to residential life in downtown Baltimore.
Really smart reuse of those buildings. And thank you for that story, Kevin Litton. And thanks for being here today again. Kevin Litton, who covers commercial real estate development for the Baltimore Business Journal, one of the busiest men in show business. Thank you very much for being here.
Thanks, Dan.
Next up is Christopher Llewellyn Reed, our midday film critic, along with Linda DeLibro. Chris, nice to see you.
Great to be here again, Dan.
We have two films you want to talk about today. First, Grand Budapest Hotel. This is a Wes Anderson film, The Adventures of Gustav Eich, a legendary concierge at a famous European hotel, and the lobby boy who becomes his most trusted friend. How'd I do with the plot?
That's great. I need say nothing more. So I just want to say at the start that no matter what I say about the film or what criticisms I may levy towards Wes Anderson's oeuvre, if you are a Wes Anderson film, I think you will like this film.
If you're a fan of his films,
I think you will like this movie very, very much.
Okay.
Wes Anderson has made 8 features in the last 20 years, and so that gives you a sense of his not that rapid pace. He takes a lot of care with every movie that he makes, and that care is visible in every single frame of his film. If you Google Wes Anderson Symmetry right now, you'll find an amazing short video on Vimeo that shows how carefully he plans every frame, and that is both, for me, a strength and a weakness of his work.
Hmm.
I love Wes Anderson films. I hate Wes Anderson films because that sense of artifice and whimsy is both what attracts me to them and keeps me outside of the story, an observer looking in rather than a participant. But what What is fascinating about this film, though, is beyond that usual care of each and every single frame, we have layers upon layers of story. It's like a Russian nesting doll. It starts off in the present, then quickly flashes back to the 80s, then to 1968, and finally settles in the 1930s, where Gustav, as you said, Monsieur Gustav, the concierge of the Grand Budapest Hotel, marvelously portrayed by an amazing Ralph Fiennes, he manages this hotel with great care, much like Wes Anderson manages with great care the frames of his films. And he takes good care not only of the hotel, but of his particularly elderly female clients, many of whom he sleeps with. And this is what basically sets the plot in motion, because one of them dies leaves to Monsieur Gustave a painting, Boy with Apple, that his family refuses to give up. And so the film is filled with this family drama. It's quite gruesomely violent, by the way.
Really?
Because the members of the family take extreme measures to keep Boy with Apple out of his hands. And it turns into sort of a meditation on the savagery beneath the surface veneer of civilization. And it's a wonderful story looking ahead at the brutality of Nazis about to come. It takes place in the 1930s. And again, if I weren't kept out of the story with that whimsy and artifice, I think that I would have enjoyed this look at the rise of Nazism even more.
Criticism. Now, the clip you have is Gustav with Zero.
That is correct. So
the lobby boy?
Gustav ends up gaining a sidekick, a lobby boy Zero, played by the wonderful Tony Revolari. And in this scene, he meets Zero. He didn't know that he was about to have a lobby boy, and you'll hear him walking through the lobby of the hotel, barking instructions at his staff while he interviews Zero.
Who are you?
I'm Zero, sir, the new lobby boy.
Zero, you say?
Yes, sir.
Well, I've never heard of you, never laid eyes on you. Who hired you?
Mr. Mosher, sir.
Mr. Mosher?
Yes, Monsieur Gustav.
Am I to understand you've surreptitiously hired this young man in the position of a lobby boy?
He's been engaged for a trial period, pending your approval, of course.
Perhaps, yes. Thank you, Mr. Mosher.
You're most welcome, Monsieur Gustav.
You're now going to be officially interviewed.
Should I go and light the candle first, sir?
What? No. Experience.
Hotel Kinski, kitchen boy, 6 months. Hotel Berlitz, mop and broom boy, 3 months. Before that, I was a skillet scrubber.
Experience zero.
Thank you again, Mr. Gustav.
Straighten that cap, Anatole. The pleasure's mine, Herr Schneider.
Mr. Asbusters.
These are not acceptable.
I fully agree.
Education.
I studied reading and spelling. I started my primary school. I almost finished.
Education, zero.
I'm sorry. I like the sounds of this.
Yeah, it's quite enjoyable in many ways, and it has a lot of the great things I like about Wes Anderson films like Rushmore. But then again, it keeps me outside of the story.
You also saw Divergent and have a quick review for us on this, Chris. This is said to be the new Hunger Games.
Yes, and that's part of the problem. And in fact, Wes Anderson makes films sort of in reaction to the ubiquity of sameness of so many blockbusters. So this is based on 25-year-old Veronica Roth's best-selling trilogy, Divergent. Second book, Insurgent, third book, Allegiant. And it's a series that I'm struggling to complete right now because the writing sort of is very, very derivative. So it's a post-apocalyptic world where one young woman must rise against the tyranny of the system under which civilization struggles to rebuild itself. And
do you mean an action-oriented female heroine?
I do. It sounds just like The Hunger Games, doesn't it?
Can we listen to a clip?
Absolutely.
Amazing, isn't it? Everything we think of that makes up a person, thoughts, emotions, history, all wiped away by chemistry.
Four.
He's gone. And we're all safer for it.
Safer? How are we safer?
The brilliance of the faction system is that conformity to the faction removes the threat of anyone exercising their independent will. Divergence threatened that system. Don't get me wrong. There's a certain beauty in your resistance, your defiance of categorization. But it's a beauty we can't afford.
So that was Kate Winslet, the bad guy of the film, the head of one of the factions against which Beatrice Pryor, played by a sadly miscast Shailene Woodley, is struggling against. And so you heard a little bit of what the plot of the movie revolves around, divergence, and the divergence sort of battle against the system of factions that have been imposed on humans in this post-apocalyptic Chicago. It's not a great film, and the central problem is that miscasting, sadly, of Shailene Woodley, whom I loved so much in The Descendants and The Spectacular Now, but she is no Jennifer Lawrence.
Did you say you're trying to get yourself through the trilogy?
I am. I'm struggling in the third book,
though. You are devoted. Christopher Llewellyn Reed, who joins us here once a month for a Midday on Film and from time to time to review films on Midday. Thank you very much, Chris.
Thanks, Dan.
Appreciate that very much. Thanks for tuning in to our first hour today, the Midday Weekly Review for March 21st, 2014. Please stay tuned for the news. Coming up, we're going to take a lunch break here and get some Joe Squared pizza provided every Friday for our guests. So please stay tuned for the news for NPR and then the second hour of Midday.